Does he have a wife?
And a couple kids, two, three kids, something like that.
Oh!
Has Rachel came back home yet?
Huh?
Has Rachel came home?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
I know, I didn't see a big dog.
Oh, God, I took him back.
He's a huge animal.
That's quite a joy. Just be taking care of all of her children is that dog.
Oh, Jesus.
Well, how did you meet Morris?
Oh, I met Morris on the bus. Let me see. I did. On the Olson Highway bus. And we were passing the Federal Reserve Bank. And you could see those huge doors coming down. And I said to him, so what's the purpose of this?
Did you know him then?
No, we used to talk with each other.
On the bus?
On the bus, you know. And at that particular time, I had no thought of ever be coming any progressive at all. Then we talked, and then he began to make sense to me. Then he said that this is the place where they steal the people's money and they conceal it in the Federal Reserve Bank. And he says, why do you think your tax money goes? You know, I said, I have no idea where it goes. And from one conversation to another, then this happened for weeks. And then eventually he invited me to attend the Civil Rights Congress, which was held at that particular time at the Radisson Hotel, I believe it were. And that's where I met you. So I went once, and then I began to like it very much, see, and then with the different speeches, and they began to outline the program of the Civil Rights Congress and the objectives of it, you know, and their fight against Jim Crow and discrimination, segregation against the Negro people all as a whole. Then I actually got interested in that.
What year was this?
Oh, I think that was back in the... It was before the Wallace campaign here in Minneapolis.
Oh, 47.
I think around 47, 47, 48. And that's how it began, you know, getting into the progressive movement.
Hmm.
And then I said to myself, in other words, I really had a complete different outline on life. I mean, he completely changed me all around. Just talking to him and going to the party, the Progressive Party, and, you know, and people explaining the whole goddamn thing to me. Something had never been explained before. In the South, until I was actually 34 years old.
Oh. Where did you live?
Well, I was born at a country town called Kruger, Mississippi.
Kruger,
C-R-U-G-E-R.
Kruger. So, well, you really got a taste of the South.
I did until I was 24 years old.
That's one place I've never been.
No, in the South. There's a place, and we do have there, at my particular time when I was living there, some very brilliant Negro people there. Then we had some there, what we call today, not only in Mississippi, but throughout the whole entire United States. We call them Uncle Toms, a sellout to the progress of the Negro people. Now, I was born in a log cabin with no floors, no screens, and partial no doors. And then at a particular time, they didn't have doctors for mothers when they gave birth to kids. They had what they call, in those days, midwives. You probably heard that yourself.
Yeah. They still have mother north side.
Oh, I see. Well, that was the one that taking charge of me, and not only myself, but the rest of the 7 kids that my mother gave birth to.
Well, you got one? So was she domestic?
She was what they call a field hand on the, a sharecropper on the plantation there, which this guy, he definitely owned it, acres and acres of land. And of course, he would build a shack for anyone, you know, that he thought was old enough to become a family, such as a kid, if a boy was 56 years old, he felt that he could take care of 25 or 30 acres of our land. He built him a shack and get the license for him, and he get married, and so forth.
Well, then he didn't
have to wait. I mean, it was sharecroppers. This had worked. Mm-hmm. I mean, the sharecropper, it means that through you, he's supposed to furnish you a certain amount of provisions, stuff like this, groceries, stuff like that. And then, if you were able to make 25 or 30, I should say raise that, incorrect now, 35 of our 40 bales of cotton, then half of that go to him automatically freely, you know.
For the land,
for the use of you staying there. In other words, you're doing you a favor. Then the rest of it, it would pay for your food. And your clothing was so poor, in fact, you practically was didn't have any clothes, just these old overalls, you know. And boys 16, 17 years old would go barefooted. In my time when I lived in Mississippi. And I'm quite sure things hasn't changed too drastically up to today. I went to work in the fields when I was a kid, 8 years old.
Eight.
Yeah. That's been exactly, let me see now, I don't want to tell you my age, exactly 30, 30, that isn't the beginning. We must start at the beginning of before we get to the picking of the cotton. Now, the first thing we must deal with is that you begin. I'm beginning at the first of the year. So for instance, like January come in. This is beginning the first of the year.
Yeah.
I mean, there is the, what we call them in our day, when I was coming along, the leftover stalks, you know, the cotton stalks, you know, leftover from the past year. We put it that way. Then, okay, during that period of January, we kids got to go to school. I would say from the past December up until March.
Yeah.
Now, getting back to January now, we had the entire month of January to go to school. February come, mean the rains disappear.
Go right ahead, I'm listening.
The rains disappear, and the sun began to come out.
Betty, would you talk a little lower? I'm recording, and I'll get you all out.
As I said, the sun would come out during the last period of February. And that meant that it's going to dry the earth, you know, what become available for cultivating. And then that meant we kids had to be off from school at least a couple of days in order to get the, what they used to call them, breaking the stalks in those days, cutting it down and getting ready to prepare for, you know, to begin another season.
Did you just plant it?
Yes. You cut the tops off first, and then otherwise, then you would begin to plow those under. Now, we did this on the days which was available for us to do these things, see. And then if it rained, then we still, then we could go back to school. Then, if it dries up again, that means the end of your school. And actually, come down to bring it, I mean, bring it very, make it very clear to you, that the average Negro, when I was in the South as a teenager, we got at least, all together, about, I would say, 2.5 to 3 months of schooling. Out of a year. And that, the highest they teach there was to the so-called ninth grade, which we had insufficient teachers because, I mean, well, they taught as much as they know. Mm-hmm. Then, the school was completely out. There wasn't any more school. Although the whites went 9 months, just like they do here in school. And Negroes, I would say, when I was going to school, got at least 3. Then you would, they would close our school down on the 15th of April. And then from then on, the only thing that you did was to cultivate your cotton and your corn. Your ground was already prepared. You did that between times. Now you begin to plant your cotton. Okay, take about a week to plant about 35 or 40, 50 acres of cotton. You plant it. Then you wait another couple of weeks till it to materialize and grow up high enough so it can be cultivated. Mm-hmm. And then in the meantime, while you're doing that, you go over to some other space where they give you privilege of growing corn. You plow that up and begin planting corn. I mean, for the rest of the day. So that was it. Then you would get your corn planted. Then your next step was to you're getting ready to go. You're ready to cultivate now. They had what they call the first step in cultivating your cotton would be, they used to call them harrows in those days. I mean, they went right side, two, three teeth was in front of the other. Mm-hmm. This one's right close to the cotton and the other one's back here to drag the dirt out to the center of the, center of the row, I should say. Then you do that, and then here we come along to chop the cotton.
You have to do it with a hoe, huh?
With a hoe, yes. All this was done by hand. You go through chopping the first time, and then you would rest about a week and let it grow up a little bit higher. You don't chop it all the way because it's too young. Then you come back the second time, which you got about, I would say, an inch, 12 inches high. Then you would, they call it, in those days, what the hell they call it? Thinning it out, you know, getting your perfect stand, the one that's going to continue to be there for the rest of the season. Well, then you do that. There's no more cotton cut on. Then from then on, you would watch this cotton grow from day to day. Now, when they get about, 24 inches high, then you begin to, it would develop, you would develop to this point that went along about this time of year, about the last part of July. and the 1st of August. Then they would have what they call getting ready to lay by, which is, I don't know what the hell they meant by saying that. But anyway, if they're letting the cotton, they're no longer going to cultivate it. They're not going to do anything. So they go in there and they put their last, we put our last row through there. And then the next thing we would do, we would get a hoe and go through and chop any vine that we thought that would prevent the bolls from opening on the cotton. It's about, around about 5 or 6 feet high at that, you know, along about the latter part of August to get ready for picking. So you go through and chop every vine out. You mean opening? Uh-huh. Then accumulate boll weevils. You completely destroy that.
Uh-huh.
Because in other words, just have a perfect feel for picking.
Uh-huh.
Then after so-called lay-by, then you were permitted then to so-called make a little extra money. In the meantime now, after August, you didn't get any more money from the boss. You were on your particular own until you picked out a bale of cotton and he ginned the cotton and sold the seeds. So now, where must we go from here? The next step were he had to have his winter wood, you know, for the stove and his fireplace. He, in terms, would suggest to my dad or myself that I go out and cut him cordwood, you know, cordwood for the stove. I went out with another grown man at the age of 15 years old and sawed and split and racked 3 cords of wood a day. I think a cord of wood is 8 foot long and 4 feet high and 4 feet wide. Is that correct?
Just about. I know that.
Buying a little nourishment around the house because so many kids there, and I was the oldest one. And naturally, that the parents did have in mind, with a little understanding that that I should kind of help look out for the rest of the family.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, but I had grown to the period that I'd been pretty, I mean, kid 56 years old, he wanted to look something nice for himself too.
And when
does it when it's really get ripe, the middle of September, but it doesn't get completely ripe till middle of October.
You mean for picking?
For picking, yeah. They go to the bars, and then half, you get the rest of the half, and then you take your half, and figure that's out of it. Then if you don't make enough to pay it, then he would say, "Now you didn't come out even this year, but maybe do better next year. Now, do you want the money for a loan?" And he said, "Yes, I want for a couple $100, which was a great amount of money in those days. He let you have it just in order to keep you intact all the time.
You'd pay interest on it."
Oh yeah, it's 25 cents on the dollar.
25 cents on a dollar?
Sure. Back in 1925.
You could never get
those things managed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is there any more questions we ask? We're getting a little bit tight now. We go through a little later on. And very fond of fishing, and swimming. Of course, in those days they didn't have swimming trunks, and we kids used to get in the lakes. There was no such thing as beaches.
And we have lakes around, rivers, or lakes?
Lakes, yeah, muddy lakes. And of course, we kids that, would watch the grown people and avoid them as much as possible. And then we would go swimming. And sometime they would, especially my mother, and not only my mother, but all the other rest of the kids' mother, were definitely opposed to we kids going swimming because so afraid we'd get drowned. And they would come down sometime and catch us in this water with nothing on. And then they would call to us, and then we'd be 15, 16 year old boys, you know, we'd be so ashamed to come out and say, come on out anyway. And they'd have they'd have something on the bank waiting for us when we got there. Oh, Jesus Christ. And, well, it's not that anyway. So that was actually one of the highlights of when I was a kid. And of course, that was another thing we had to do is when we were children, that we had to attend Sunday school every Sunday.
What religion were you?
Oh, she believed in Baptist and
Baptist.
Yeah, you know. And of course she had me to believe in that too, and of course I was baptized. And but I always thought within myself, even since, from a kid, that there was something phony about the whole thing, but I just... I actually didn't... And my father... I separated when I was a kid.
Oh.
Unfortunately, that they did, which I think today has a little bit of bearing on the conditions of we children and why we don't have the respect for each other like we should.
Did you let it?
At that particular time, I was only 17 years old. I was the oldest one, and the rest of them you can well understand where they were. So then she, at that particular time, my mother was a very, very beautiful woman. And she left home. And my stepfather remarried again.
Then she left your kids?
Yeah, she left the kids. And of course, I was already gone. And they didn't get the attention that they should have gotten if they had a mother.
Mm-hmm.
Continue in my mind that I don't know whether my mother did the right thing by leaving the children.
Did she have any mother?
Well, now, if any more questions you want to ask now.
Well, then when did you leave home? When did, probably when you left home then?
I was 17 years old, 1947. I went to a place called Sumner, Mississippi.
What'd you do? Just leave or walk down the road? Or did you have a job somewhere? Or?
Well, no, I had no job in mind. I had heard of kids leaving home and then they go and work as what they call houseboys in the South, you know. Somebody to cut the yard and mow the lawn and wait on the tables.
I suppose the family kind of wants a boy to leave though after he gets to be a good laborer, do they? Or do they want him to leave?
Well, they doesn't want him to leave.
No.
So then they put me out of the back there, and of course I bunk and I stayed there. I had to be in the kitchen every morning around about 7:30, you know, and get things going, wait on the table. They did teach me, you know. In fact, I should give them credit for teaching me as much as I know about cooking now.
Oh.
See? And they would... ...were a certain point, but as a kid, you know that you get homesick just ever so often, and then you want to go back and forth, you know, which they can't stand too much.
You went home sometimes?
Every, I had to go home every month. Kids.
Because you didn't
I can
have
go-
to give them any of your...
No, I didn't give them any at all. I could go down in the afternoon and come back that same night. So, I mean, that made the difference. So I went there, about 4 months. And then I take off and go back home. And stays there.
You save some money then?
The whites. And of course that they were my superior. And don't do anything that you thought would offend them.
And what was the
basis? From my parents. An experience that I recognized myself through lynching in Mississippi and terrorizing the Negro people.
Did you have anything?
I take it back. I did have an experience of lynching the family. My mother's baby brother was killed. This white landlord was going with his wife, and he even forbidded my uncle to even to see this woman, although she was a Negro woman. And so he insisted upon continuing his relationship with her, and he was killed.
How old was he?
At that particular time when my uncle was killed, I think that was in the year, I'm quite sure it was in the year of 1933. Yes, it were, 1933, in a place called Greenwood, Mississippi, very close to Money, Mississippi, where Emmett Till was lynched. If anyone had told me back in those days that I would ever have the privilege of even sitting in your company or any other white person's company, I would have said that you're very mistaken. It'll never happen. The theories of Marx and Leninists and the progressive-minded people have showed me different, that there will come a day that Negro and white will sit and talk together and live together in peace. I have that feeling. Because
there's so many things happened.
It have proved itself. It's come a reality. It has. That I never dreamed, Ms. Robeson said, would ever happen.
Yeah. So fast, too.
So fast. Mm-hmm. Never thought of it. I mean, the term... And the backwoods of Mississippi, as Robeson always said. Where segregation and discrimination originated in my state where I was born, I'd never thought that a Negro ever would have an opportunity. I'm going to speak about Dr. Luther King of Montgomery, Alabama, You know, he said there's a new self, and which it is.
Mm-hmm.
Now, 10 years ago, no one could ever make me believe that this bus boycott in Alabama would ever take place. Where's the new South today?
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be the entire thing, entire situations, going to happen all over.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the old South like it was when I was there.
No.
It's a new South.
No, they can't stop it either.
They can't stop it. I will continue this, I will say period of information some other time.
Yeah.
Oh.
Coyote that stays in there, it's so cool.
Throughout your career?
Well, I must confess that at the time that I'm portraying these roles, each one is my favorite because I have to do my best, you know, and you can't be partial. And they're all in different categories, so that brings out either the best or the worst in you. And I hope it brings out the best. It's really making my favorite.
Well,
tonight with me in the performance is an opening night.
Good. That's the way it should be, too, isn't it? And this is why you've been successful for so long.
Well, I've been blessed. No, I don't. It's all in the hands of my maker. He knows if I'm to get back there again. But right now, I'm doing what I feel is the most beautiful job that I am able to participate in. Because I sing each night, with Billy Graham Crusade Choir. And, darling, I get so much more than I give that I feel a little guilty.
Right.
Every night in here, the word of the Master, my Heavenly Father, and be among such friendly, warm, loving, gentle people.
Well, but you know...
No, I only had the one life to talk about.
You have but one life to give to the literary world.
Right.
Well, Miss Waters, are there any plans to make the book into a movie?
I don't know, because they seem to want to do things with it that I don't, I'm not in accord with, and above all, the main thing is they don't want me in it. And I'm the one that lit his eyes on the sparrow,
yes.
And I'm still, I hope, one of the Lord's little sparrows. So it's grounded if they don't use me in some part of it.
Right.
I find it a beautiful city, and, you know, if you've ever been to Europe, the Montmartre part of Paris is a great deal on the pattern of New Orleans.
But I don't think I'm as nervous as Warren is today.
You don't think so? I don't think you look a little nervous to me right now, as a matter of fact. Let's see. Yeah, you're shaking a little bit. You got to hold him up, you know.
The only thing that hasn't lost its glamour is love and love alone. What does it matter if you're rich or you're poor? Fortune and fame, they never endure, for love is a thing. Love is a thing. What good is money if your heart isn't light? And in each other's arms, you'll be wealthy tonight when you have its fling. Love is a thing. While others fight for power, you can stroll among the flowers, knowing that the best thing in life is the thing that's free. Love for you and he. And even though your castle may crumble and fall, you both will have the right to laugh at them all. For love is still king. Love is the thing. Bless you.
It was impossible for me to use the dining facilities in the dime stores and the department stores in the city of Nashville. But today this is possible because hundreds of students, armed with only a dream, fought one of the greatest battles this country has ever known. As these restless, freedom-hungry students fought, there were many emotions. There were many tears, yet many smiles. There were moments of sadness, yet moments of joy. As we fought with our weapons of love, the lines of communication that had been broken for decades were mended, and understanding replaced misunderstanding. Confidence replaced uncertainty, and love replaced hate. As we fought, despair died, yet hope was born in the hearts of thousands. For a few minutes, let us share with you some of the rich experiences we have had in this great battle against racial discrimination in the city of Nashville, Tennessee.
Everybody.
Okay, all you kids are under arrest. You'll have to leave. You're under arrest.
Thousands of people from all over the nation have asked what it was in these students' minds that made it possible that they could endure the rebuke and the raw hate of their antagonists. For most of these students, it was a revolt against compromising Negroes, hateful whites, unfair laws, and gimmicks that enslave human personality. These students wanted an end to hypocrisy. They wanted to live the democracy of the national anthem and the Supreme Court decision. It was a matter of dignity and self-respect. They would no longer compromise with the degrading evil of segregation. The students wanted to end hate as well as segregation. They realized that an eye for an eye is an obsolete ethic and creates a society of blind men. They realized that the moral laws of the universe must be obeyed by the oppressed as well as finally by the oppressor. They were willing to cut the century-old chain of hate and replace it with redeeming love and forgiveness. They were willing to suffer the taunts of the hateful and absorb the hate in their own bodies. They realized to do this takes courage and discipline. It was a part of their religious and democratic faith. They were willing to place the total weight of their personalities behind the statements of the prophets and the Sermon on the Mount. They wanted to make every man of goodwill realize that the moral weight of the universe could be brought down upon Nashville, Tennessee. They hoped finally to dramatize the evil of our system and forever tear away the Southern stereotype that Negroes like segregation and have a certain place. But beyond integration, they wanted to build the beloved community where men could begin to live together as brothers.
Silas bound in jail, had no money for to go their bail. Keep your eyes on the prize, oh, 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 oh. Keep your eyes on the prize, oh.
The hefty, bright-starred, blue-coated city policeman pushed and crowded these students into paddy wagons, while other well-dressed students stood on the sunny downtown sidewalks waiting their turn, without regret or without fear. The policemen thought they could break the students' resolve by taking them to jail. This only increased their desire and deepened their conviction. It became an axiom in the movement that whatever was done to destroy the movement only helped its momentum. In jail, these students made up songs, joked, and proved that there's no dishonor when you're in jail for the wrong reason. Listen to them.
Segregation alone, lived next door to a man, and he had a lot of children, and so did my dad. But we weren't allowed to play together because they were white. But we had two dogs. He had a dog, and we had a dog. And our dogs would always play, and so we wrote this song. Dog, 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 dog.
My dog, I love your dog, and your dog, I love my dog, and my dog, I love your dog, and dog, I love my dog, and dog, I love your dog, and dog, I love my dog, and dog.
Down the civil rights, all the justice have come to Tennessee.
Yeah.
country just ain't gonna bend no mind, but I'm moving on.
Hey, moving on.
Hey, moving on.
Hell, and they come confusion and all the commotion, as we can plainly see in the mind of this man. There was no hell, there was no confusion, and there was no commotion. They sat there. Well, why didn't you serve them?
Well, that's our policy. We reserve the right to choose our customers.
They're Americans, aren't they? They can shop at all other counters, and they can work behind the counters, the lunch counters. But yet, they can't eat at the counters. That's your policy, and that's your position. That's all you want. The defense rests.
Anything else, prosecution?
No, nothing else. The city rests.
Your Honor, the defense recommends that the case be dismissed. We can plainly see that there was not a single violation of our city law or ordinance. But if you please, Your Honor, there was only a violation of this man's policy and tradition.
$50 fine. Pay your fine or go to jail.
Go to jail. Abiding reason why they could no longer endure segregation, why they were willing to go to jail. Let's ask some of them what their personal reasons were. John Lewis, why were you willing to stick out your neck, take a chance on going to jail?
Being from a small city in Alabama, this was my first opportunity to do something about racial injustice in the South. My mother wrote me a letter and said, "Get out of the movement," but I couldn't. I couldn't, for along with me, there were many more students who were trying to make democracy a reality. I wrote her and said, "I have acted according to my conviction and according to my Christian conscience. I can do no less, and if God be with me, I will continue to do so. I went to jail more than one time. I was arrested 4 different times on 4 charges. 2 disorder conduct, 2 conspiracy charges. And if I have it to do again, I will do it. My soul will not be satisfied until freedom, justice, and fair play become a reality for all people. There is something deep within me that forced me to speak out against social injustice."
Thank you, John Lewis. Here's another. Marion Barry, I'm told that you took a chance on losing a $4,000 scholarship, that you took a chance on not receiving your master's degree because of your involvement in the movement. Why?
I feel that each day in our classroom, we've been exposed to, we've talked about, learn about the democratic process and ideas of democracy. But it makes me sick deep down inside to think for over 100 years the Negro has been abused, has suffered indignities bestowed upon him by the white man, has been told to go to the back, has been called inferior and second-class citizen. I have found that I cannot continue to live myself. I have found that I, as an individual, must do something about this regardless of what the other people feel. That I, as a Negro, have suffered these things too long. That it is time that I, along with other people, have to start doing something about this problem. I have been to jail and took a chance on losing a scholarship or not receiving my master's degree. But to me, if I had received my master's degree and had taken the scholarship and still was not a free man, I was not a man at all. I was only part of a man. And I felt that in order to be a whole man, I must be an American citizen as anybody else. I must be able to enjoy the same liberties and same freedoms that are guaranteed us by the Constitution of our United States. Thank you, Marion. Here I see the leader of the Student Advisory Committee, Miss Diane Nash. They tell me that you almost flunked out of school because you spent so much time in the movement. They told me that you were harassed, and I want to know why.
Well, Reverend Vivian, as you know, I came to Nashville for the first time last September. This was also the very first time I had been in the South. But still, I was at home because I was in America. During the first few days I was here, I learned that there was only one movie theater in the entire city, which is the capital of Tennessee, to which Negroes could go without having to enter through a back door or an alley entrance or climbing up to the ceiling of the balcony. I couldn't believe it. Actually, it took about 10 people to convince me that this was a real fact. And then I noticed that it was often the case that the entire lives of most of the students at the Negro school to which I attend were spent on campus simply because there was no place to go. These were college kids who were investing thousands of dollars in their education, who had to spend 4 years of their young lives, which should be enriching, without the rights that belong to them. Now, this had a tremendous psychological impact on me. And for a while, I found myself absolutely unhappy because I felt chained, and I didn't see a reason for it. I couldn't believe that I didn't have a right to sit at those lunch counters or to do anything else any of the other citizens of Nashville did. I couldn't believe that the children of my classmates would have to be born into a society where they had to believe that they were inferior. Also, I couldn't get a degree and get A's this semester and be happy at the same time, knowing that there was such a tremendous wrong in the city. And I couldn't be happy not trying to do something to correct it, because I want a good America, and I want that just a little bit more than I want a degree.
Nashville will never be the same again. From the time the students sat in at the counters, things began to change in this city. The Negro community realized for the first time that they had at their disposal a weapon that would allow them to do what they'd wanted to do for a long time. And on every hand, aid came to the student. Now everyone realized that he had a share, whether he was rich or whether he was poor. There was something that he must do in order to change the complexion of our city. The day that the students were...